May I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. Today is the fifth Sunday in the season of Lent, traditionally known as Passion Sunday, because from today we begin the 10 days that mark Passion Tide. The second week of Passion Tide is Holy Week, which begins next Sunday with Palm Sunday. There's much more to unpack about the controversial nature of Jesus' entry into the city, but you will have to tune in next time for more. So at the heart of Holy Week and our Easter observance lies a very thorny question indeed. Is the Jewish critical language, that is the language highly critical of the Jews, in the Passion narrative, particularly as interpreted by Matthew, but also by John? Is the Jewish critical language anti-Semitic? And I raise the question, you see, because especially on Good Friday, we're going to traditionally hear some of it. Although here at St. Martin's, we take remedial action to try to lessen the impact of it. The response to the question requires, more specifically, to know how to read a Jewish critical language in the Passion story within the lens of the historical context in which it's written. Now, in common speech, we talk about the Gospels, plural, but if we look at the title of each of the four Gospels, we discover that there is only one Gospel, the Gospel of Jesus Christ according to. And it's the according to that reminds us that this is the gospel of Jesus Christ through the lens of a particular writer who gives us his interpretation of the life and times of Jesus, shaped through the lens of his own history and context. Now, Matthew wrote for an emerging messianic Jewish community. There are no Christians in this time period. There are just messianic Jews and non-messianic Jews. And Matthew's writing for a messianic Jewish community, recently expelled by the rabbinical reforms that had categorically rejected Jesus as the Messiah. And Matthew's messianic Jewish community and the fledgling rabbinic movement struggled for the upper hand in the contested revisioning of Israel's ancient story. And 30 years later, John, writing for a Jewish broad tent melting pot community, comprising of open and closeted messianic Jews, the remnants of John the Baptist's disciples, a sizable group of Samaritans, and as the gospel reveals today, an increasing number of curious Greeks. This patchwork of messianic remnants, often in tension with each other, faced a very fierce oppression by the anti-messianic Judean Jerusalem religious establishment. Now, the tone of Matthew and John's Jewish critical language represents this intense intra-Jewish factional conflict. But is it anti-Semitic within the modern meaning of the term? This question evokes resonances to a very similar question that we're grappling with today. Is Israel critical language, that is, language critical of Israeli policy and action in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, anti-Semitic? To criticize Israel, is that to be anti-Semitic? And these are both questions, both the historical one and the contemporary one, are important, crucial questions as we prepare in 2024 to commemorate the events of Holy Week and Easter against the backdrop of the Israeli devastation in Gaza. As our heightening awareness of the injustice and brutality of Israel's occupation of the West Bank trigger a resurgence of anti-Semitism nationwide and around the world. Now, it's important at this stage to more closely define what we mean by anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the hatred of the Jews. Its roots lie not in the New Testament period, but in later Christian acceptance of a doctrine called supersessionism or replacement theology, according to which God had rejected the covenant with Israel made through Moses in favor of a new covenant with the church who become the new Israel. Now, despite St. Paul's vehement rejection of this doctrine, by at least the 4th century, supersessionism has led to the scapegoating of the Jews as being collectively and for all time held responsible for the killing of Jesus. And anti-Semitism was further strengthened by the peculiar position that Jews were forced to occupy in Christian society from late antiquity to the early modern period. Despite their cultural and religious exclusion and isolation, the church's prohibition against usury, that's Christians lending to each other and charging interest on the loan, resulted in the Jews becoming the lenders of choice for Christian monarchs and merchants. Deprived of the right to own land, lending money was one of the few activities that Jews were allowed to perform. And thus Jewish money bankrolled European mercantile and political expansion in the medieval and the early modern period. Now, with respect to any bankers present here this morning, everyone hates bankers. What I mean is, we all resent those to whom we owe money, those whom we are indebted to. And so, what not to dislike in Shakespeare's stereotype of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice? And what's not to resent in Viktor Orban's anti-Semitic stereotype of George Soros as the face of an international Jewish conspiracy controlling world affairs and pulling the strings behind international events in the gradual subversion of Christian civilization? And so the belief in an international Jewish conspiracy dominated the 20th century, and it led directly to the Holocaust. And in the aftermath of the Holocaust catastrophe, mainstream Christianity, Protestant and Catholic, emphatically and publicly rejected supersessionism to reaffirm Paul, who as the earliest Christian writer taught that despite the inauguration of the new covenant with the world through the death and resurrection of Jesus, God nevertheless remained faithful to the earlier covenant made with Israel. And what's not to like in an image of a God who does not renege on previous promises? Now, as we move to commemorate the events of Holy Week and Easter, we have to confront this issue of the language, particularly in John. And two principal difficulties arise from the Jewish critical language in the Passion story. The primary difficulty is the projection of their political context back into the Jesus timeline. Presenting the intra-Jewish conflict of the evangelist's day as Jesus' conflict with the Jews in his own day. And the second difficulty is that later on, Christianity misinterpreted the gospel Jewish critical bias as supporting fully fledged Christian anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism is the abiding sin of the Christian church. And on Good Friday, our encounter will require us to substitute John's drumbeat refrain, the Jews. He uses it indiscriminately. Sometimes he's referring to the crowds. Sometimes he's referring to the high priests. The Jews. The Jews. And we need to find an alternative. When John uses the phrase to refer to the incitement of the crowds, we might substitute the people for the Jews. And when John uses the phrase to refer to the religious authorities, spearheading Jesus' journey to the cross, we can simply say the authorities to distinguish them from the people. In doing this, we're not trying to exonerate John of the charge of anti-Semitism. Quite the opposite. We are taking care not to project later anti-Semitic tropes back into the gospel text. More importantly, however, substituting terms as I'm suggesting allows us to more clearly understand the essential nature of Jesus' growing conflict in the events of Holy Week. Because his is not a conflict with the Jews of his day, despite sometimes the way the evangelists present it. His conflict is a much larger one. It's the confrontation with the agents of empire. We need to understand Jesus' final week leading him to the cross from both a historical and a cosmic perspective. On the historical level, we need to see in the events of Holy Week the culmination of Jesus' mission of non-violent resistance to the forces of empire, which establish and maintain peace through the perpetuation of violence. And on the cosmic level, we need to understand the events of Holy Week leading to the cross as God's struggle against the powers and principalities that take up lodging in the human heart, so to enlist us in their conspiracy and resistance against the coming of the kingdom. And we enter Passiontide in 2024, particularly aware of the nature of so much suffering in the world around us. And we find ourselves wriggling uncomfortably beneath the shadow of the cross, where we are tempted to feel daunted and overwhelmed by the scale of the work God calls us to collaborate in. You see, we are called to work tirelessly to dislodge evil from its inhabitation of our hearts through truth-telling and justice-making and spiritual restoration, to disembody conspiracy and give it no place to hide by exposing it to the light. One truth, one heart, one act of courage and compassion at a time. Amen.